Hey, what's up, guys, and welcome back to Paranormal Activities. It is just now the week of Halloween, and I am trying something new this time. I'm doing an episode about Halloween, but not the holiday, but the movie, the original 1978 Halloween. I'm doing it in a true crime-style podcast. Think Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, telling the story like it's real, like it happened. Something I'm trying different, and if I like it, I'll continue to do with other movies, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, things like that. I do still want to keep doing the real stuff, absolutely. I'm definitely going to continue to do that, but thought this would be fun. I love Halloween, I love Michael Myers, and I thought, why not give this a try? So it's going to be a three-parter. This first episode is going to be from the original 1978 Halloween. Like, all the events are real. Take some liberties, because movies only provide so much, and you have to make it make sense. So I do take some liberties, throw some nods to books, to other movies, things like that. So this is going to be part one. Part two will be the events of the Halloween 2018 and Halloween Kills, as those two films kind of become the next canon sequels. For those of you who don't know, it's a big mess, but just trust me. Halloween 2018 is a direct sequel to Halloween 78. Followed by Kills. In 2018 and Kills take place the same evening, so I'm going to be doing those two together, like it was one series of events, and that will be the end of part two, and then part three will be the events of the new movie, Halloween Ends, which came out 2 weeks ago, but the events technically haven't happened yet, as it takes place on Halloween night 2022. So, once that's done, once the Halloween night is over, I will create that episode. This will be a three-parter of Halloween, the night he came home. Hope you all enjoy it, and if you don't, I apologize. On this show, we have talked a lot about ghosts, demons, extraterrestrials, but one thing we haven't talked about is the boogeyman. But what is the boogeyman? Is it something born in hell that walks the earth? Or is it something more? Could the boogeyman be born human and then shape into something else? From a child predator who was burned alive in his factory, rumored to haunt the families that killed him in their dreams, to a child who drowned at a lake only to come back years later to seek vengeance on those responsible. There are several stories about the boogeyman, but today, we're here to talk about one man. One man who personifies what it means to be the boogeyman. Michael Myers. On October 19th, 1957, Michael Audrey Myers was born at the Haddonfield Memorial Hospital, located in Haddonfield, Illinois, and he was born to Edith and Peter Myers. And for the first 6 years of his life, Michael seemed to be a pretty normal kid. It was reported later that he was kind of quiet, and that one weird thing he did was he would stand inside his sister's bedroom and just stare out the window, looking outside. But outside that, he seemed to be a pretty normal kid. There was really no issues with him that anybody really noticed. Now, fast forward to October 31st, 1963, on Halloween night, Michael Myers, using a kitchen knife, stabs his sister, Judith Myers, age 17, to death in her upstairs bedroom, while wearing a clown mask and a full costume. And that mask and costume was actually purchased earlier that day with Michael and his mom, Edith Myers, at the Nichols Hardware Store. And actually, Mr. Nichols later recalled, after the investigation, that Michael and his mom were actually in the store earlier that day and bought the costume. And Mr. Nichols recalled that Michael didn't seem off, didn't seem weird, didn't really say much, but he was there with his mom, held her hand, did the whole thing with no real issues. But now, later that night, Michael's again stabbed his sister to death in the upstairs bedroom. And shortly after, Michael's parents came home from a party that they attended, and they saw Michael wearing the clown mask and the clown costume in a catatonic state while holding the bloody knife on the sidewalk just outside their house, right out their front door. Apparently, they pulled up, and Michael was just standing there in his full costume, holding a bloody kitchen knife. Now, earlier that evening, their neighbor, Mrs. Blankenship, who was an elderly widow who lived across the street, was babysitting Michael before Judith picked him up. And Mrs. Blankenship told the authorities that Michael did seem quieter that night than usual, but again, did not show any signs that he would kill his sister that same evening. Which is interesting, because you would think if he was going to murder his sister, he'd be thinking about it, or there'd be signs of, you know, the storm coming, I guess. But, you know, he was 6 years old, and in November of 1963, Michael is court-ordered to receive medical treatment at the Smith's Grove Sanitarium, located inside Smith's Grove, Illinois. And, again, he was 6 years old, so clearly he's not going to be assigned to, you know, an adult prison or anything like that. I don't even know how you would charge a six-year-old or, like, you know, what their sentence would be these days. But in 1963, if you were six and you killed your sister, you were brought to the local sanitarium, and Michael was actually assigned to Dr. Samuel Loomis as his primary doctor and psychiatrist. Now, when Michael stayed there, he was in an outpatient or anything. He had to live now at the sanitarium and basically only be interacting with Dr. Loomis going forward. And then tragically, fast forward 2 years, in 1965, Michael's parents were both killed in a car accident. And after this, the state then became solely responsible for Michael Myers. And so now, Dr. Loomis basically becomes the only father figure, I guess, for Michael. Now, after working with Michael for 8 years, Dr. Loomis realized that Michael, as he quotes many times over the years in different reports, different documentaries, different whatever, he diagnosed as Michael as pure evil. And it's, again, later recalled, who we will talk about a little bit, Sheriff Brackett, but Brackett also quoted Dr. Loomis as saying Michael was purely and simply evil. And not only that, but that Michael Myers had the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. So that was after the first 8 years. Now, Michael was incarcerated for 15 total at this point until what we get into next. So after the first 8 years, Dr. Loomis said that Michael can't be reached and he is evil. Now, for the next 7 years, Dr. Loomis advocated for Michael to be locked up with no opportunity for parole, and pushed for Michael to be sent to a maximum security prison or a maximum security psych ward, whichever is more equipped to handle Michael, as he believes that Smith's Grove, which is at this time a minor offender facility, low level, whatever you want to call it. And he claimed that he does not believe that Smith's Grove could actually hold Michael Myers, as he called it unfit. And also at this point in time, throughout these 7 years, more importantly, after the first 8 years of trying to reach Michael, Dr. Loomis stopped calling Michael a him or a he in conversation, and he began calling Michael an it, which really kind of threw people off. It's a weird thing to say. You know, if you're responsible for somebody or you're taking care of somebody, calling them an it seems inappropriate, especially for a child. Because again, Michael was only 6 years, and what's 6 plus 7? I'm not very good at math, but what, 14? So when he's still just a teenager, 13, when he's 13 years old, he starts calling this kid an it. But at the same time, Dr. Loomis was experienced, and as events unfold, maybe he wasn't incorrect. Up until 1978, Michael remained at Smith's Grove. And at this time, during these years, Smith's Grove did transition from a minimum security prison to a medium security prison, just to kind of fit Dr. Loomis' needs. And at this time, it seemed like more offenders were doing more things, and they felt the need to up the security prison for whatever reason. I don't know why they did that specifically. Couldn't really find it, but they did transition from a low level to a medium security prison in that time period. But Dr. Loomis still said, it's not enough, and we need to put Michael somewhere else to wait out the rest of his life. Which is kind of a weird thing to say about, you know, a teenager. But it is what it is. Also, during this time, Dr. Loomis was quoted in saying that all Michael will do is stare out the window. Michael no longer spoke. His parents did claim that he used to talk when he was six. But after the night in 1963, he never said a word, according to all the records that, you know, are public and to be seen. Michael never said anything. He never talked to Dr. Loomis. He never talked to the police. He never talked to his parents, who did visit him until their death shortly after. But there were just no words spoken. They claimed that, the doctors claimed that Michael's throat was fine. He had no issues, no medical issues, no bruises, no damages. But for whatever reason, Michael just stopped talking. And Dr. Loomis thought that there was a reason for this, and that Michael basically just stopped talking, and all he did was start sitting and staring at a wall, staring through a window, just waiting for a secret trigger inside his brain to set him off. And that's basically what we did for the next 15 years, just like Michael. Dr. Loomis waited for Michael to do something, as he thought that he might. And that brings us to October 30th, 1978. On a stormy night, Dr. Loomis and his colleague, Nurse Marion Chambers, arrived to Smith's Grove Sanitarium to pick Michael up for a court hearing that was scheduled for 8 a.m. on October 31st, 1978. Now, why they picked him up that evening and he wasn't transported, you know, in a different way that morning, I don't know. I'm not sure how these things worked in 78 or even now in 2022, to be honest with you. I don't know. I thought that was strange, but they had a vehicle with, you know, basically a police car-like vehicle, and they were just assigned to transport him, bring them to Hardin County, which is also strange as Haddonfield is in Warren County, but I guess they didn't want people, you know, had to be a fair trial or whatever. I'm not really sure the details, but it is what it is. So anyway, on October 30th, 1978, when Dr. Loomis and Marion Chambers arrived to pick up Michael at Smith's Grove, they found that there were multiple patients from Smith's Grove outside, wandering around the front yard of the sanitarium, just aimlessly walking around in the rain. And obviously that's pretty crazy. So at this time, they drive up to the gate. Dr. Loomis gets out of the vehicle to call security from the main gate intercom. At this time, obviously at 78, they don't have cell phones or anything like that, but they do have those gate intercoms all over. So as Dr. Loomis was trying to call security at the intercom, Michael jumps on top of the car, breaks out the passenger side window with his hands, and then Marion escapes through the driver's side door. Michael jumps in the driver's seat and takes off. So now, Michael Myers is gone. After how many years of just sitting in his room, he officially escaped Smith's Grove Sanitarium. So now, fast forward one more day, October 31st, 1978, Dr. Loomis is trying to figure everything out, still at the sanitarium. They do their investigation. They figure out exactly what happened. And Dr. Loomis advises the Smith's Grove administrator, Dr. Wynn, that he believes Michael is going back to Haddonfield. Dr. Wynn blows him off, think that would be impossible, because, one, Michael Myers can't drive. Two, I mean, as far as we know, he can't drive. He's been incarcerated since he was 6 years old, so why would we believe that he could drive? Two, how would Michael know how to get to Haddonfield? I thought I had it written down, but I don't see it here. But Haddonfield was a couple hundred miles away. I forget the actual amount of miles now, but it was pretty far from where Haddonfield is, from where Smith's Grove is to Haddonfield. So basically, they thought that's impossible. They called the police, obviously. They put out an APB on Michael Myers, and they thought, we'll catch him, because, one, he'll probably wreck the car. You know, who knows? But clearly, he can't drive. But Dr. Loomis solely believes, firmly believes, that Michael is heading back to Haddonfield. So he jumps in his car, and he takes off. And just to kind of throw this out there, I did look up Dr. Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen was the administrator when this went down, and he remained the administrator of Smith's Grove up until 1995, where he died from natural causes, just short of his retirement, which is kind of sad. But is what it is. So now back to Halloween, 1978. While Dr. Loomis is heading to Haddonfield, he stops at a payphone that's just 73 miles outside of Haddonfield. At this payphone, for those of you who know what payphones are, I know they're kind of outdated these days, but at this payphone, Dr. Loomis calls the Warden County Sheriff's Office to warn them about Michael's arrival. You know, he had to convince the deputy, but whatever. He did stop there to tell, hey, it's Michael's coming. While at that payphone, Loomis looked over and saw an abandoned work truck from Phelps Garage. He walked over to the truck as the door was still hanging open, and it was off the road, not on a path, just, you know, in the grass on the road. So Loomis went to the truck, saw that there was a state-issued Smith's Grove gown, the same kind that are issued at Smith's Grove, like a patient gown, was hanging off some bushes and in the truck. And he also noticed a rabbit in red matchbook, which according to him matched the same matchbook that Marion had the night prior when they went to pick up Michael Myers. Now, I'm not really familiar with matchbooks, as I was never a smoker, and I always use lighters these days to light my grill and whatever else. But apparently a matchbook is just that. It's a book full of matches. And back in the day, you used them if you were a smoker. You had them all the time. So that was enough evidence for Dr. Loomis that it's no longer a question, but it's a fact that Michael is heading to Haddonfield. Now, kind of jumping forward for just a second, it was questioned later if Loomis saw anybody at this car site. Dr. Loomis stated that he did not see a body, but only the matchbook. And then once he saw the matchbook, he took off. Later that day, a state trooper also stumbled upon the same truck, and not too far from the truck in some bushes, the body of Christopher Hastings, a 33-year-old mechanic from Phelps Garage. His body was found, and it appeared to be he was stabbed brutally in the stomach with an unknown object. Apparently, they were like deep punctures, maybe a screwdriver, something along those lines. But he was found there, murdered not too far from the truck. So this appears to be the very first victim of Michael Myers after his escape from Smith's Grove Sanitarium. Now, moving on to Laurie Strode. I'm trying to tell this in a story-like content to make everything make sense. And so now, before we continue, I want to talk about Laurie Strode for a second. Laurie Strode is a 17-year-old senior at Haddonfield High and also is a babysitter for Haddonfield and basically babysits local kids. Laurie's father, Morgan Strode, is a realtor at this time in 1978. And in Haddonfield, at this time, he was in charge of selling Michael's childhood home, which was dubbed the Myers House. On Halloween morning in 1978, Laurie Strode, along with a kid she babysits by the name of Tommy Doyle, remember that name, were walking to school. When Laurie dropped off the key at the Myers House, per her dad's request, this will be Laurie's, basically her last normal morning. The events that unfold later this day make investigators believe that Michael was in the house at the exact same time when Laurie dropped off the key. And then they believe that Michael continued to follow Laurie and Tommy to school. Now, that's being said because of what unfolds next. While Laurie was in her literature class that morning, she looked out the window and noticed a man in a white mask, later to be discovered. You know, this man is obviously Michael Myers, but time she doesn't know that, but she saw a man in a white mask standing next to a station wagon staring at her. Laurie said she turned away for just a second, and when she looked back, the man in the mask and the car were both gone. Now, later, it was also discovered that a kid named Richie Castle believed he ran into the same person after his school let out. Richie told his parents, and then later the investigators, that while running from the school, he turned into a weird man wearing a white mask. The man grabbed Richie and then let him go. And Richie happened to go to the same school that Tommy Doyle attended at this same time, which leads us to believe he was also following Tommy along with Lori. So after Lori's school went out, Lori was walking home with her friends Annie Brackett, age 17, and Linda Van Derklok, weird name to say, age 18. And Lori's friend Annie Brackett happened to be the daughter of Warren County Sheriff Lee Brackett. Also remember that name. While walking home from school, the same car that Lori spotted while in her class was being driven by a man in a white mask as it passed Lori and her friends. She claimed that it slowly drove by them, staring at them as he passed. Annie Brackett yelled something at the car. Lori was unable to remember what during her police interview, but to remember that she yelled something about speeding or something along those lines. After Annie shouted at the car suddenly stopped, and after a few seconds, the car drove away. As they were walking home, Linda reached her house first, and so now it was just Lori and Annie walking together when Lori again saw the same man in the white mask. This time he was standing next to a bush or some kind of shrubbery and was staring at the girls from in front of them at this point. Lori told Annie to look up as she was messing around with something, and by the time Annie looked, the man had vanished. Annie attempted to confront the man, thinking he was hiding in the line of shrubbery, but when Annie approached, he was gone. It's important to note here, after reaching Annie's house, Sheriff Brackett actually ran into Lori. During his interview to break down the events that come later, Brackett mentioned that he thought Lori looked a little shaken up and a little distracted, and it was a little, you know, she seemed different than usual, like scared, I guess. But at the time, didn't really think about, you know, didn't think too much of it. And then once Lori reached her house, having calmed down a bit, and went, she went to her upstairs bedroom. While going close to her open window, she went to close the window, and while she looked, she noticed that the same white man was standing in her neighbor's yard, staring at her through the bedroom window. Shortly after this encounter, Annie called Lori, and Lori again told Annie of the man staring at her. Shortly after this, as they were getting ready for the night, Linda actually stopped by Lori's house and also mentioned to Lori that there was a man staring at her while she walked up to the house. So they're all seeing, or not all, I guess, but Linda and Lori are both seeing this guy, you know, more than once throughout this day. And now moving on to Dr. Loomis and Sheriff Brackett. And so Dr. Loomis does finally reach Haddonfield, and when he gets there, he first goes to Mount St. Clair Cemetery to check on, to check on Judith's headstone. I'm not really sure why he would do this, but it's believed that, you know, he thought that Michael's obsession would draw him there, as Judith, his older sister, is Michael's very first victim. And Dr. Loomis believes that Michael has a strong connection with Haddonfield, with his house, clearly with his sister, so maybe he would go to the grave. But as Michael is being brought to Judith's grave by the innkeeper Angus Taylor, they found that the tombstone was not there. Angus Taylor later reported that he thought it was a prank, but Dr. Loomis thought that was very, very odd, as he was going to take a tombstone. Shortly after this, Dr. Loomis does find Sheriff Brackett, who was at the time responding to a break-in at Nichols Hardware Store, which is the same hardware store where Michael got his clown Halloween mask back in 1963. It's hard to believe that's a coincidence. Maybe it is. But I personally believe that Michael remembers getting his clown mask at this store, and he went back to the same store to get his new mask. Also, keep in mind, I know that this is a weekday and the store was closed in the middle of the day, and that does, I saw on the internet, that does drive people crazy here and there. But remember, it's a small town, and a lot of stores were locally closed random days throughout the week, and they were opening on the weekends because they had busier weekends. And Nichols Hardware Store was a family-owned, locally-owned hardware store, and they were actually closed every Monday and Tuesday, and that way they have their owners have time off as well, but they stay open on the weekends, you know, because people buy things on the weekends. And also, the same break-in, the only thing stolen was a Halloween mask, a rope, and a knife, which is also odd in my opinion. Now, at this point in time, Loomis and Brackett, they head out together. Brackett really doesn't believe at this point that Myers would be coming back to Haddonfield, as it just isn't likely. But Loomis convinces him, we need to take this more seriously. So later, they go together to the Michael Myers house, which has been abandoned since 1963. No one's lived there. The parents died in the car crash, as mentioned earlier, and nobody bought it. It's up for sale. There's showings, but nobody has yet bought this house. As you know, there's murders in the house. It's a known thing. It might be haunted, that kind of stuff. Once in the house, Loomis and Brackett found a dead dog in the living room of the abandoned house. Loomis thought that Michael had killed this dog and ate it. Brackett argued that it looked like it was chewed up by some kind of animal, but Dr. Loomis insisted that he believed Michael came home, got hungry, and ate a dog. Which is kind of sad when you think about it, but who knows? You know, maybe it is. Also at this time, Brackett, in a later interview, described Dr. Loomis as very afraid, very shaky, and once he got to the house, his whole demeanor of being ready to go to stop Michael, it became more of a, I'm afraid of Michael, I think he's here, I don't know what we're going to do. But he claimed that Dr. Loomis was very shaky, very afraid, and that Michael was nothing more than evil on two legs, according to Dr. Loomis. Sheriff Brackett believed at the time that Dr. Loomis was paranoid and was over-concerned, but now, after the events of this night, he does actually believe Dr. Loomis and believes that Michael is nothing more than pure evil. But now, moving on, Brackett and Loomis do believe that Michael is here, but they do not yet notify the press, as they did not want to cause panic at this time, as Haddonfield, again, is a small town with basically rows of houses. And if the news that there is a basically an escaped, you know, an escaped former killer, not a serial killer yet, by, you know, technical terms, but basically an escaped patient from an insane asylum is in their town, that would basically freak everybody out. But obviously they did inform every police officer, every sheriff's deputy that was here, and they had everybody looking for Michael Myers, but really they had no leads. You know, at this point in time, they knew that there was a mask stolen, but I'm not sure they really thought that was Michael Myers yet at this time. They have not yet talked to Laurie Strode, so they don't have a description of a man in a white mask. They just know that Michael Myers, the guy who they know of, they know what his face looks like, well, Dr. Loomis does anyway, knows that he's out and he's running around. Now, Halloween night, 1978. While Laurie was scheduled to babysit Tommy Doyle, who we mentioned earlier, age 8, and at the same time, her friend Annie was scheduled to babysit Lindsay Wallace, also age 8. The Doyle and the Wallace houses were very close, just across the street and down a little bit from each other. And Laurie also explained in her statement later that Linda and her boyfriend Robert Sims, named they call Bob for short, who's also 18 years old, or I guess is 18 years old, everybody else is 17, went to the Wallace house as they had planned on using the house for a small gathering. That was the plan, I guess, from what I could kind of gather. While babysitting Tommy, Annie dropped off Lindsay at the Doyle house, telling Laurie that she was going to go pick up her boyfriend Paul and bring him back to the Wallace house as well. And this is the last time that Annie was seen alive by anybody, unfortunately. While babysitting both kids, Tommy said and exclaimed and freaked out at one point, claiming that he saw the boogeyman outside, staring in through the window. Laurie calmed down Tommy, thinking that Tommy, just being a kid, he's 8 years old, it's Halloween, they're watching horror movies. I didn't really think anything of it, which I thought was strange, because Laurie also claimed that she was seeing a guy stalk her that same day. maybe I would take Tell Me More seriously, but I don't have kids. I don't hang around with 8-year-olds. I'm not sure, you know, how I'd react with that being said. But I just feel like, you know, if I was being stalked and a kid I was watching said he was being stared at from a window, I'd take it more seriously. But what do I know? So anyway, Lori calmed down Tommy, and then she actually called the Wallace house to speak to Annie, assuming she'd be back by now, as she said she'd be back in less than an hour. But at this time, Linda actually answered the phone and explained that she was at the Wallace house, but Annie was not yet there, and she was not there when her and Bob arrived. Lori told Linda to have Annie call her once she got home, because she wanted to make sure that, you know, Lindsay was going to be okay. Shortly after, Lori received a call, assuming it was Annie calling her back. When Lori picked up the phone, all she heard was sounds of gargling, and then the phone disconnected. At this time, Lori looked out the window and saw the Wallace house lights come on, and then they went out. Lori put Tommy and Lindsay to bed at this time, and then walked over to the Wallace house to make sure everything was okay or to see what was going on. Kind of assuming that she was being pranked, but also kind of nervous because she was being stalked all day. When Lori walked into the house, the lights were completely out. Lori then made her way upstairs, still kind of assuming it was a prank, but still unsure. Once she reached the upstairs, Lori walked into the bedroom where she could see an orange light illuminating through the door, which ended up being from a lit jack-o'-lantern. Upon entry, Lori discovered the dead body of Annie Brackett laying spread out on the bed inside that bedroom, and was also in front of the missing Judith Myers headstone. What the fuck? You know what I mean? Just going to put that in your guys' heads. Michael Myers went to the graveyard, took a tombstone, brought it to this house after stalking Lori all day, killed Lori's friend, then put her body in front of this headstone, kind of recreating like a cemetery. That is pretty messed up, you know, and for a guy who was literally inside a sanitarium for 15 years and didn't say anything. And this is the first thing he does once he gets out in the wild, as they call it. Pretty messed up. And you can look at other serial killers. There's, you know, a ton. Basically, you can go on Netflix right now and find a 100 documentaries of any given serial killer. But this one is pretty wild, just from that alone. And even if that's where it ended, it'd be a WTF thing. But unfortunately, this is just where it starts. But anyway, she finds Annie there, and Annie had signs of strangulation with a slashed neck. So it looks like she was strangled, and then shortly after being strangled, or while being strangled, her neck was slashed. So clearly, obviously, Lori freaks out about that. And Lori then, while kind of freaking out, walking through the room, she also then discovers the body of Bob Sims hanging upside down in a closet in the same bedroom. It was found that Bob had a very large stab wound going through his upper body, through his chest, and it looked like it was probably a knife, but it went through the entire body. You could literally see a hole through his body that went to the other side. Pretty intense. So Michael clearly staged these bodies to be found by Lori. Probably. And that's not where it ends, though. Lori then, shortly after discovering Bob's body, she discovers the dead body of her friend Linda Van Der Klok in an opposite closet. It appeared that Linda died from strangulation with a wire of some sort, and it's believed just how the bedroom phone was laid scattered across the floor, and going along with what Lori heard on the phone earlier, it's believed that Linda was strangled with a telephone cord while she was talking to Lori, which is pretty sad. You know, she's a 17-year-old kid. Her friends were also, you know, the same age group, seniors in high school. And then she just found all of her friends dead, which is pretty rough. And the authorities actually talked to Paul, Annie's boyfriend, later that evening, and he never was picked up by Annie. So it's believed that Annie never even made it out of the house. She was probably murdered somewhere and then brought and staged in that bedroom before she had the opportunity to go pick up Paul. But now, moving forward, shortly after discovering her friend's bodies, she was kind of frantic and in shock in this bedroom when Michael Myers emerged from behind Lori and stabbing at her, striking her left arm and leaving a large gash, which still has a scar, down her left arm. As this stabbing occurred, Lori turned around and then fell down the stairs and then was immediately chased by Michael Myers. Lori attempted to escape and she ran through the kitchen, but once she reached the kitchen, she closed the door behind her, locked it, and then ran to the door that goes outside the house. So like she's running to the kitchen that has a different door. I'm not sure why there's so many doors in this house. It's the 70s. I didn't grow up in the 70s, so I'm not really sure how it worked. My house has an open plan. I don't know. But apparently, Lori closed the door behind her in the kitchen and locked it. And then she runs to the door that goes outside. Here, unfortunately, Michael Myers had apparently planned all of this out and had this outside door locked and jammed with a rake, blocking the handle so Lori could not open the door. Michael then punched through the door that Lori had previously locked. He apparently, the door was found later with a big hole in it, Michael punched through it and unlocked the door that way. So at this point, Lori did the same thing. Lori used her hand and punched or smacked her way through the glass, then continued to flee. At this point, Lori reported that she had yelled for help, but the neighbors didn't respond, and one neighbor even turned off their porch light after Lori pled for help. And when I hear that, I'm like, you know, what would I do in that situation? You know, if someone's banging on my door, screaming for help, would I let her in? What I assume is a Halloween prank, because it is Halloween night, you know. I don't know what I would do. I'd hope I would be the person who lets her in. But I live in a sketchy neighborhood sometimes, you know. I don't know what I would do, but I would hope that wouldn't be the case if it was me. But that neighbor did turn off their light and kind of left Lori hanging. So at this point in time, Lori made her way back to the Doyle house where she was babysitting. And there she discovered that her key was gone. She did not have her key, so she's now banging on the door, screaming for one of the kids to let her in. Tommy Doyle wakes up, and he hears Lori yelling, comes down, unlocks the door, and Lori is now in the house with the doors locked. She orders Tommy to go back upstairs and basically to hide. And now here as we go from it, or maybe this is when it becomes a thing, but from man to boogeyman is what I believe happens here. Because now, after Tommy goes upstairs, Lori is sitting there. She had grabbed a knitting needle, which I guess it's one of those big ones. I've never been a knitter, but it's a very large knitting needle when she realizes that the living room window is open and she can hear breathing. So she grabs the needle. And at this point in time, Michael is actually behind the couch that Lori is kneeling over. Michael gets up, lunges at Lori with a kitchen knife from behind the couch, just missing Lori and stabbing the couch itself. At this time, Lori takes that needle that she grabbed and she puts it into Michael's neck, right in the center of the neck. Michael stands up, grabs the needle from his neck, and then falls to the ground and is motionless. At this point, Lori believes that she had killed Michael Myers. So she runs upstairs, tells the kids that she actually killed Michael, and as she's talking to the kids, Michael is now walking up the stairs. How a needle of that size did not really do major damage to Michael is why I think he is considered to be the embodiment of the boogeyman, because that is just one injury after doing things that make no sense already, knowing how to drive, driving to your hometown, which you haven't been to in 15 years, and getting there while killing people in your path. Like, he's already doing things that aren't human, And now he actually has physical damage and he immediately recovered. So that's crazy to me. But anyway, Michael walks up the stairs and immediately gets noticed by both kids, Tommy and Lindsay. So they start screaming. Lori turns around, tells the kids to go into the nearby bedroom, while Lori runs into the master bedroom that's located upstairs in this house. Lori opens the doors that lead into a little patio or a little deck, I guess, outside the upstairs bedroom. She opens that door, and then she runs into a closet and hides in the closet. And here is where I think Lori is really smart for her age, I guess. Because she's 17 years old, she's being attacked by a maniac, and she opens the other doors and then runs into a different door and hides in a closet. And then not only does she just hide and try to trick Michael where she's at, she takes a metal coat hanger, which you guys might know what it is anymore. Like, I still have metal coat hangers in my closet. But she, wire hanger. I guess I should say wire rather than metal. But she takes a wire hanger and she forms it and she wraps it around these closet doors. And that's how she locks herself into this closet. Michael notices that she's in the closet because he is apparently smart as well. And he can't open it because the wire hanger is keeping it closed. So he punches through this wooden closet door while Lori is in there, basically at this point probably screaming from what I imagine. But again, Lori is really resourceful with these wire hangers apparently, as she takes another one and she forms it and she actually stabs Michael in the eye with this wire hanger, hits him right in the eye. And then he drops his knife because of that injury. Lori picks up this knife and she stabs Michael directly in the chest. Straight up stabs him in the chest with a kitchen knife. A very large kitchen knife. Now, Michael drops to the ground, again, motionless. Now, Lori is in shock. She walks out of the closet. At this point, the kids have already run out of the house screaming their heads off. And as the kids are running out, Dr. Loomis, who was still at the Myers home, noticed that the vehicle that he was driving the night prior that Michael had stolen was parked just a little bit down from the Myers house, Michael's childhood home. While walking, he sees the children fleeing. So Dr. Loomis assumes that Michael Myers must be in this house, which is the Doyle house. So that's happening while Lori is still in shock. And as she's in shock again, thinking that she killed Michael Myers, Michael somehow apparently had gotten up and he again attacks Laurie Strode. Now, as she's attacking Laurie Strode, he jumps out of the bedroom and is basically strangling her. And as he's strangling her, Laurie grabs the white mask that Michael has been wearing all day and pulls it up. This causes Michael to let Laurie go and he puts the mask back on. At this exact same time, Dr. Loomis runs up the stairs, sees Michael Myers, and now shoots him with the revolver that he had been carrying all day. So he shoots Michael once, and that shoots Michael Myers back into the bedroom where he just was. Loomis then runs into the bedroom and just unloads. Basically, he has a six shooter. He already shot him once. He runs in the bedroom, sees Michael standing there, and now he shoots five more rounds into Michael's chest. For those of you bad at math, like myself, he shoots him six times in the chest now, which pushes Michael back onto that balcony that's on the upstairs bedroom, and he falls off the balcony onto the ground back first. Loomis then turns and checks on Lori. Once he ensures that Lori is okay, he goes back to the window of the balcony and sees that Michael is gone. And that's it. Loomis told responding officers that he had vanished. He claimed that he had shot him six times, said this guy is not human. He got up and he vanished. Now that's crazy. in my opinion. So at this point in time, for those of you keeping track, Michael was stabbed with a very large knitting needle in the neck, stabbed in the eye with a wire hanger, stabbed point blank in the chest with a kitchen knife, and then shot 6 times with a revolver, and then fell off a 2-story balcony. And then he just gets up and walks away. Like, what is that? And as far as I'm, you know, that just doesn't happen. There's all kinds of killers out there. You all can watch the documentaries. I'm sure a lot of you have. And that just doesn't happen. I mean, there's like, people can take a lot of hits, but getting shot 6 times, getting stabbed all at the same time. While at this point, remember, he's only 21 years old. His body isn't even fully developed yet at 21 years old. But that happened. And that leads us to the apprehension of the boogeyman. So after all of this happened, Dr. Loomis immediately contacted Breckett, found him driving outside, and informed him to bring everybody to the Wallace house, as that's where Myers was just at, and he just walked away, and he is still at large. Loomis expressed that, again, he had shot Michael in the chest 6 times, and that multiple deputies heard Loomis express this over and over and over on the radio, and whenever they saw him, Loomis wouldn't stop talking about it. He just kept saying, I shot this guy 6 times. That's crazy. And I'm sure these deputies probably didn't really believe him. I'm sure that they thought he missed. I know Brackett mentioned in his statement at the end of all of this, he thought he missed after hearing that. But, you know, it is what it is. They knew Michael was just at this house and that he had killed people. And so now, once at the Wallace house, Sheriff Brackett does realize and see that his daughter, Annie, is one of the victims. And at this point, he withdraws himself from this investigation and immediately goes home to tell his wife that their daughter was murdered. Yeah. And then, so now at this point in time, Michael is still on the loose. There are 4 deputies who were at the Wallace house and then began to pursue Michael on foot in the surrounding area after the bodies were discovered. I mean, clearly Michael couldn't have gotten that far. And so they didn't even get in their cars. I mean, there's multiple vehicles on the scene already. They just took off after him, basically. And now they realize that officially there is an active serial killer on the loose in the small town of Haddonfield. While the deputies were pursuing Michael, they kind of split up, and rookie deputy Frank Hawkins saw a man in a white mask who he believed to be Michael Myers at this time walking down the street. Hawkins called for backup, then pursued Michael. As Hawkins approached and yelled at Michael from a distance, ordering Michael to freeze, Michael stopped, turned and looked at Hawkins, then proceeded to walk down an alley. When Hawkins followed Michael and turned into the same alley, Michael had seemed to vanish. At this time, the other 3 deputies met with Hawkins in the spot where Michael did disappear. The 4 deputies split into 2 groups at this time for Michael, to 2 groups of 2. Deputy Hawkins and Deputy Pete McCabe were walking when they saw a kid named Lonnie Elam, age 11, also remember this name, on the sidewalk holding his eyes closed and yelling gibberish about the boogeyman. So at this point, everyone is calling Michael Myers the boogeyman, which is kind of crazy. When the officers approached Lonnie, he said the boogeyman was just here and he seemed to vanish. And after this, he bounced. Apparently, Lonnie just ran away at this time. And Lonnie goes on to have kind of a criminal record. But again, that doesn't matter. Just remember this kid's name. So at this point, Officer Hawkins and McCabe then realized that they were right in front of the Myers house and saw the same station wagon that Myers had reportedly stole the night prior. So it is what it is. So now the deputies assume that Michael is in this house. And so they go into the Myers house. Hawkins stated that McCabe saw a dead dog while they were separating, sweeping the house. McCabe was in Judith's bedroom. At this point, I'm not sure exactly where Hawkins was, but Deputy McCabe was standing inside Judith's bedroom when Michael attacked McCabe, attempting to strangle McCabe from behind. Hawkins heard the struggle, ran to the bedroom, and ordered Michael to let go of McCabe while pointing his gun at Michael Myers. McCabe then drew his weapon, attempted to shoot Michael at point-blank range while Michael was behind him, but unfortunately, McCabe missed, struck himself in the neck, and at this point, Michael then released McCabe and walked into the next room. So now, at this point, we have Deputy McCabe with a gunshot wound to his neck from basically point-blank range that came from his own hand, and Officer Hawkins ran up to him, attempted to shoot Michael Myers as he walked away, but missed with each shot. So now we had Michael walked away, Michael walked down the stairs to walk outside, and then Hawkins saw Michael leaving, but heard the cops coming, his partner's coming, and then ran back to McCabe to basically try to provide some kind of medical care from this self-inflicted wound by McCabe. One thing to note, a medical examiner, name not included in the report that I saw, noted that McCabe's gunshot wound did appear to come from more of a distance than point blank and didn't reflect a typical self-inflicted gunshot wound, but there was no follow-up investigation and the case was closed as a self-inflicted injury. I'm sure that's how it went down, but just want to point that out as that is out there. So now at this point, Michael exits the front door, and there are multiple officers and deputies from all over Warren County and surrounding counties, as at this point they have basically called everybody as there is a massive serial killer on the loose. And so as Michael walked out the house, basically going to the same place that his parents had found him with a bloody knife 15 years prior, police surround him, along with Dr. Loomis, who is here now at the Myers house. And Michael is basically standing behind him, runs inside to see what was going on, and then comes back out and is basically standing behind Michael Myers on the sidewalk. Michael was then taken down by one of the deputies, was put on his knees. Dr. Loomis approached Michael from behind and attempted, which is kind of crazy, he's a psychiatrist, he's a doctor, but Michael Myers walks up from behind Michael Myers, who is now taken down on his knees, and attempts to shoot Michael, execution style, point blank, from behind. But Officer Hawkins runs down the steps, stops Dr. Loomis from shooting Michael, point blank in the back of the head, which probably, honestly, saved Dr. Loomis from some charges. Because at this point, I mean, it is 1978, but at this point, Michael Myers is taken down, no longer a physical threat as he looks to be, submitting to the police. But as he shoots off the round at Michael's head, Hawkins does interfere, saving Michael Myers' life and probably Dr. Loomis from some charges. And Michaels was then immediately handcuffed and arrested without further incident. So that is one hell of a murdering spree on his first night back in the wild, as they say. I'm just going to keep this going here just to see what happens next. January of 1979, Michael Myers was sentenced to remain at the Smiths Grove Sanitarium with no possibility of parole, which was still a medium security holding facility. Short of the maximum security that originally was desired by Dr. Loomis for several years. Now, Michael does remain at this institute for another 40 years. During the court hearing, while on the stand, Dr. Loomis states that Michael Myers needed to be executed and the body should be destroyed as there was nothing to gain from evil being kept alive or reclaimed. Michael was not executed, however, but instead of being executed, he was studied by over 50 types of doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, basically any kind of doctor that deals with the brain. They studied Michael Myers. They kept him at Smith's Grove. They did up security a little bit. They made sure that he was always chained up. There was always something going on with him. He was on constant watch. But still, Dr. Loomis felt it was short of the necessary standards to confine the evil that was Michael Myers. While Michael was contained at the Smith's Grove Sanitarium, he became the main focus of several documentaries, several TV shows, several special editions like 60 Minutes and shows like that, true crime. And as time went on, several podcasts, which, today there's a billion of them. And over the years, he actually inspired several horror movies, all kinds, some loosely inspired, some more inspired. But with, the inspiration of his story, a lot of horror movies were filmed, and Michael Myers is actually credited to be the thing that brought life back into the genre, which is, kind of crazy. Over the years, there have been several theories and rumors on what made Michael go on the killing spree, but in the end, Dr. Loomis had the only true diagnosis. Michael Myers is nothing but pure evil. In 1995, Dr. Loomis passed away from heart failure, never succeeding to see Michael's real confinement in a maximum security plaza or being there to witness Michael's death, which is what he really wanted. But unfortunately, he did pass away, and shortly after he passed, a former student of his by the name of Dr. Ranbir Sartain took over and became Michael's primary physician, primary doctor, primary psychiatrist, whatever you want to call him. And again, as Michael stayed at this asylum, he showed no signs of being aggressive. He showed no signs of wanting to even leave the prison. He again would just stare at a wall. He was cooperative with all of the standards of the facility. And for the next 40 years, showed all of the signs of being the perfect patient.